2 Samuel 18. In our study, we've been going through David and his son Absalom's heartache. It's a terrible thing for a man to have to go up against his own son. But David was instructed by Nathan the prophet that this would certainly be the outcome of his sinful ways. There's always pain involved with sin. And some people don't understand that. Some people have a problem with it. That why would God allow there to be this suffering or pain going on in the world? Well, we live in a fallen place. Sin is prevalent, has been since the very beginning, and we have all partaken of that. Therefore, there's going to be sin for all and pain and some dealing with that for all. And David is dealing with his share of it. And he was instructed that he would do so, that the sin was forgiven, that the debt was paid, if you would, as we understand our Lord has done for us. We are forgiven for everything we've ever done wrong. Sinning is dealt with on the cross, as you know. However, the consequences of sin can remain and can continue on. Doesn't mean God doesn't love you. Doesn't mean he hasn't paid for that sin. Simply means, hey, the consequences of sin is a death of something. Something's going to die as a result of sin. And you can't escape that truth. And some that try find themselves being very, very dismayed, very frustrated, very bitter oftentimes because they're trying to escape that truth, that reality. You can't. It's a fundamental law of God that the wages of sin is death. And the consequences of sin is pain. It just will happen. So David's dealing now with his son Absalom, who is trying now to take the kingdom away from David. What a painful time for him. And as we pick up the story here in chapter 18, the alliances have been made. David's counselor, Ahithophel, has kind of fallen away and gone to Absalom and given him counsel. However, one of David's own counselors as well, Hushai, has gone as well to Absalom and told him that, hey, I'll be with you now, so to speak, and has given him counsel as well. And his counsel was taken by Absalom. So Ahithophel has gone off now and killed himself because his counsel wasn't. And now that he realizes that Absalom's probably going to fail and David will probably kill him for abandoning him, he, of course, takes his own life. Now, this is where the story picks up, where the people now are gathered for battle. And David, it says, verse 1 of chapter 18, numbered the people that were with him and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds. And David sent forth a third part of the people under the hand of Joab and a third part under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and a third part under the hand of Ittai the Gittite. He's back. We talked about him a couple of weeks ago. And the king said unto the people, I will surely go forth with you myself also. I'll go with you guys, David says. And people said, no, you shall not go forth. For if we flee away, they will not care for us. Neither if half of us die will they care for us. But now thou art worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, it is better that thou secure us of the city. You stay here. That's what they're looking for, is for you to be out there so they can kill you. They can kill us, and they won't care about that. They're only looking for you. And the king said unto them, what seemeth you best I will do. This is an interesting thing for David to say. And I have a question in the midst of this. Where's the Lord? Why isn't David consulting God at this point? He hasn't consulted God in a long time, if you've noticed in this story. In dealing with Absalom, his son, he hasn't asked of the Lord. Here, dealing with the battle that's about to begin, you'd think he'd be on his knees, wouldn't you? What's happened to David here? Same thing that happens to us oftentimes. Grief, agony, suffering, trouble has caused him to withdraw, pull away. He's trying to figure this thing out. Now he's taking advice from the people. They tell him, well, here's what you ought to do. And he says, okay, whatever you think. Is this a way a king should be responding? I don't think so. He's not leading the people. The people are leading him at this point. So, no prayer. He just says, whatever you think, you see. And so then He, the king, stood by the gate side, and all the people came out by hundreds and thousands. And the king commanded Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains charge concerning Absalom. Don't hurt Absalom, he says. Now, again, a strange thing for a king to say about the enemy who's trying to take his kingdom away from him. But this is his son. Don't hurt him, he says. So the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was in the wood of Ephraim, where the people of Israel were slain before the servants of David. And there was there a great slaughter that day of 20,000 men. But notice this, for the battle was there scattered over the face of all the country, and the wood devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. Why? Well, where this took place was a rocky, kind of barren place where there was lots of cliffs, lots of gullies, lots of ravines, and the men trying to figure out where to go and what to do and running all over that area in the trees where you can't see very well and trying to figure out where you're going, they died in the midst of those places, falling off cliffs, and it killed more men than the sword did. In other words, the battle was really taken care of by the Lord. He doesn't need a sword to deal with Absalom, does he? He can just make people fall into pits and stuff. They can just walk off cliffs and not even realize it. The Lord's pretty handy to have. And it's interesting that he's being faithful here, even though David hasn't sought his counsel. Have you ever experienced that? You didn't really seek the Lord's counsel, but he is faithful to you anyway. Well, here we see it, you see. Now, Absalom, you recall Absalom. Remember, he was the one a couple of chapters back that we saw who weighed his hair. Remember? I mean, who weighs their hair? Absalom does. You remember? It weighed about 5 or 6 pounds. Hair. Wow. So he's got hair. Lots of it. He's into his hair. In fact, we notice that anybody who would weigh their hair puts a lot of weight on their hair, puts a lot of value in their hair, don't you think? So he's proud of his hair. Some people are like that. Some people can't be, because they don't have any hair. But, sorry guys, some of you guys go, quit it, you know. Those jokes are getting a little too often. Here's the deal. He is proud of it. He's got hair, he's proud of it. And here's the thing. Absalom met the servants of David, verse 9, and Absalom rode upon a mule, and the mule went under a thick bough at a great oak tree, and his head caught hold of the oak, literally his hair. His hair got stuck in the branches of the oak tree he ran under with his mule and got hung up, literally. He was taken up, listen, between the heaven and the earth, and the mule that was under him went away. What a picture. Absalom's running, trying to get into battle, you know, hair flowing, you know. He looks like one of those commercials. It's in slow motion, you know, the hair's flowing behind him, and all of a sudden, whoop, he gets caught up. And the thing he was so proud of was the very thing that took him down. This is so true. And by the way, isn't this interesting language I find in the King James at least, that it got hold of him and he was taken up between heaven and earth. Listen, how many people, because of their pride, get hung up between heaven and earth? He did. It was his pride that got him caught here. And there he hangs, hair tangled in the branches, mule took off. So there he is dangling by his hair. What a sight. Now, certain men saw it, verse 10, and Joab, and said to Joab, behold, I saw Absalom hanged in the oak tree. And Joab said unto the man that told him, and behold, thou sawest him, and why didst thou not smite him there to the ground? And I would have given thee 10 shekels of silver and a girdle. And the man said unto Joab, well, though I should receive 1,000 shekels of silver in mine hand, yet would I not put forth mine hand against the king's son, In our hearing, the king charged thee and Abishai and Ittai, saying, beware that none touch the young man Absalom. Didn't you hear what David said? David made it clear, don't hurt him. And why would I do that? Now, this young man's pretty smart. If you recall the story, over and over again, anybody who gives David news about someone he cares about and them being dead, what does he usually do? He kills them, right? Remember Saul, the young man that ran to Saul and said, hey, I killed Saul, you know. And David said, that was a bad idea. And he killed him, right? Everybody who gives David these kinds of bits of news that they took out an enemy of his who he loved, they were in trouble. Remember Ishbosheth, Saul's son, and the two soldiers that killed him while he was laying in bed. And they came to David and said, hey, we took him out. And David said, bad idea. And he killed him. So this guy sits here and Joab says, why didn't you kill him? And this guy went, bad idea. The records are pretty clear here for those that do this kind of stuff. I'm not going to do it. And didn't you hear David, by the way, say not to touch him? So, verse 13, he says, otherwise should I have wrought falsehood against mine own life. For there is no matter hid from the king, and thou thyself wouldest have set thyself against me. You wouldn't have stood up for me, Joab, if I would have done that. Even if you wanted me to, you would have turned on me when the time came. When David said, who killed him? You would have said, he did. This guy knows better. Joab's reputation precedes him as well. Then said Joab, I may not tarry thus with thee. He doesn't want to hear this. He says, I'm getting out of here. And he took three darts, or literally lances, in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. So Absalom's hanging there, and Joab pierces him through three times. Then the young man that bare Joab's armor compassed about and smote Absalom. 10 young guys come up and then finish him off. So Absalom's dead. They slew him. And Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing after Israel, for Joab held back the people. And they took Absalom and cast him into the great pit in the wood and laid a very great heap of stones upon him. And all Israel fled, everyone to his tent. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and reared up for himself a pillar, which was in the king's dale. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. And he called the pillar after his own name, and it was called unto this day Absalom's place. So not the grave that Absalom chose for himself. He made a pillar that he could be buried beside so that everybody would remember him. Well, now he's laying in a pit with rocks over him, basically, because of his pride, again, his arrogance. And nobody would question that Absalom needed to die, really. He had killed Amnon, his brother, mercilessly. David was lax and slack with him. And let him come back, and no sooner was he back and restored that he started this insurrection against his dad. He was a bad seed, if you would. He was, you know, trouble. And David knew he was going to be trouble. He was told that his family was going to do these kinds of things because of his own sinfulness. He was going to have to deal with things that are just part of life because of our sin. And this is such a warning, isn't it, to parents? I mean, what our kids see us doing, they will do. They will do them. They do those things. Absalom's doing what his dad did. You know, he killed Amnon because, you know, he raped his sister. And, of course, that meant he had to die. But, of course, Amnon followed in his dad's footsteps too, didn't he? Taking advantage of somebody like David did Bathsheba. And David killed Uriah, right? Got him drunk, wouldn't do what he wanted him to, so he had somebody else kill him for him, just like Absalom did his brother. All these things are played out in David's life because of what he's done. Now, nobody, again, would deny that Absalom needed to die. He needed to be dealt with. But watch this. Then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, let me now run and bear the king tidings, how that the Lord hath avenged him of his enemies. Now, Joab says, verse 20, thou shalt not bear tidings this day, but thou shalt bear tidings another day, but this day thou shalt bear no tidings, because the king's son is dead. He doesn't want this guy to run and tell the king this. He wants somebody else to do it. Who? Well, verse 21 says, then Joab said to Cushi, this guy had a cushy job. He wants this Cushi. Nobody even knows who Cushi is. He's a Cushite is really what this means. This is kind of an abbreviation for Cushite. So he's Cushi, the Cushite. And nobody knows who he is, and I think that's the point. Joab says, let's get a nobody to go tell him this. Because, again, David's got a bad habit of killing people to give him bad news. So send this guy, you see. And he doesn't want Ahimaaz to go. So, verse 21, Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, yet again said to Joab, but howsoever let me, I pray thee, also run after Cushi. And Joab said, wherefore wilt thou run, my son, seeing that thou hast no tidings ready? You're not ready for this. You don't have what it takes to go tell David this. Let somebody else do it. And if he dies, it's just Cushi. It's just a Cushite. Who cares? Basically is what he's saying. So Ahimaaz, though, really wants to go. But howsoever said he, let me run. In other words, he bugged him so much, he said unto him, run then, go ahead. Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and overran Cushi. He was faster than he was. And David sat between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof over the gate unto the wall and lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man running alone. And the watchman cried and told the king, and the king said, if he be alone, there is tidings in his mouth. And he came a space and drew near, and the watchman saw another man running, and the watchman called unto the porter and said, behold, another man running alone. And the king said, he also bringeth tidings. And the watchman said, methinketh, that's a poor term, isn't it? Methinketh. This guy obviously hadn't gone to school. Methinketh. No. He says, methinketh the running of the foremost is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. He recognizes his stride or something. And the king said, he's a good man and cometh with good tidings. He's hopeful. He's hoping, well, he's a pretty good guy. He would bring good news. That's not always the way it works. And Ahimaaz called and said unto the king, all is well, or literally peace. Gives him a false sense that everything's okay as he's still on the run. And he fell down to the earth upon his face before the king and said, blessed be the Lord thy God, which hath delivered up the men that lifted up their hand against the Lord my king. And the king said, is the young man Absalom safe? And Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servant and me thy servant, I saw a great tumult, but I knew not what it was. He says, I don't know. Did he? Of course. What happened? Bark, 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 bark. He's chickening out. He realizes he's standing in the presence of the king now, and man, this could be ugly. So he says, I don't really know. And the king says, verse 30, turn aside or stand over there. And he turned aside and stood still, and behold, Cushi came right after him, kind of on his heels. And Cushi said, tidings, my lord the king, for the Lord hath avenged thee this day of all them that rose up against thee, all of them. And the king said unto Cushi, is the young man Absalom safe? Cushi said, the enemies of my lord the king, and all that rise against thee to do thee hurt, be as that young man is. He says, Absalom's just like everybody else out there, dead. And David, verse 33, the king was much moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he wept, thus he said, O my son Absalom, my son, Absalom. Would God I had died for thee. O Absalom, my son, He starts to grieve and moan and have this real hurt in his heart being expressed. Everybody can kind of hear him in that room that's above the gate or where everybody enters in. This is a public place. And David is kind of expressing his grief. Nobody can blame David for expressing this grief, right? But watch what happens now. He goes on with this because it was told Joab, verse 1 of chapter 19, behold, the king weepeth and mourneth for Absalom. And the victory that day was turned into mourning unto the people. For the people heard say that day how the king was grieved for his son. And the people got them by stealth that day into the city. In other words, they tiptoed in. They kind of walked on eggshells into the city as people being ashamed steal away when they flee in the battle. They had to act like they were ashamed of this victory because David was going on with his grief and his mourning and his moaning and groaning, so much so that the people were ashamed of this victory. It turned the victory that they had won into mourning, into a bummer. Now watch. The king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice. He didn't care that the people were feeling shamed now. He didn't care. He covered his face and cried with a loud voice, "Oh, my son Absalom, Absalom, my son, my son." Now, in this story, you're saying, well, you're done, right? No. This is something I want to touch on today that I think is key. What's wrong with David? He's depressed. He has fallen into depression big time. And this is always something that will come up in light of what happens in life, whether the pain we endure in this life is a result of sin or somebody else is afflicting us or whatever it might be. There's always this thing to deal with. What thing? Depression. Depression's a real deal, isn't it? Sometimes depression has all kinds of, you know, reasons and things that it takes shape in us with. But here's the thing. Some people say, well, it's a physical thing for me. Maybe. Some people say, I'm overworked. That's why I get depressed. Could be. Well, it's a mental thing for me. Maybe. That's true. Possibly. But there's one thing I want to talk about here that deals with this issue, because David can't seem to get out of the funk he's in. He's deep, and he doesn't even care about the people. He could care less. That's not like David, is it? The people make a sacrifice to fight for him, and he just blows it off and makes them feel ashamed of themselves for what they've done. This is what happens with people who fall into depression and stay there. And we all face days and weeks, perhaps even months, where we get discouraged or there's problems or there's issues. Life happens to everybody, doesn't it? It just does. We are dealing with things that hurt and that are hard and that are struggles and that are painful for us. But what goes on here is important for us to take note of, I believe. David was bummed. He was probably wondering, you know, why God allowed Absalom to die? I told everybody to leave him alone. I didn't want this to happen, you see. Where's God in all this? Well, David, did you ask God about this? Many times I find depression is set on by this very thing. What? You forgot God. You just started dealing with life on your own, like David was doing here. He didn't seek the Lord at the beginning of our story here. He just did what he wanted to do. Listen to the people. Heaven forbid you listen to people. Wow. You see, people don't know what they're talking about, folks. Counselors and people who think that everybody's got an opinion about something, don't they? Do they know anything? No. People don't know what they're... Don't go to people and say, what do you think about this? Because they'll tell you what they think. And usually what they think is wrong. They don't know. Now, there's nothing wrong with sharing. Don't get me wrong about this. Don't think you can't talk to your friends or your family about things you're going through. But understand this. There is only one wonderful counselor. Only one. His name's Jesus. You see. And he is the one that knows where you're at and what you need to hear. He's the one. So here's the thing. Many of us face this same issue. I find despair and depression is prevalent in Christians today more than I've ever seen it in my life. Why? Because the world has infiltrated the church more than any time I've ever seen it in my life. There's worldliness going on. The world has affected us. We ought to be affecting it. But oftentimes we have bought into this thing. Psychology has infiltrated the church. And now we have guys that are psychological counselors. And again, psychology has its place. just not in the church. Where does it have a place? Somewhere out there. Understanding behavior is not the key to dealing with behavior. What is? Repentance. Confession. Lord, help me. Not, do you understand why you do the things you do? No. Well, let me tell you why. This will really help. You're an idiot. No. There's all these things, though, that get thrown at you. Well, here's why. Here's why you're like you are. Isn't that help you? No. You know, makes me feel worse. Thanks a lot. I didn't even know that about me, but now I do. This issue is so key. David is obviously having a pity party. Now, again, nobody's going to mock him for grieving over his son, but this is going beyond this point of grief for him. He is now depressed. And sometimes depression comes in physical forms, overworked. I agree with all those things, but most of the time they are attacks from the enemy to tell you, to tell me that what you're going through isn't right. You're dealing with something that it doesn't belong to you. You got somebody else's grief. You got somebody else's problems. You need a new life. You need somebody else's life. You need to start envying and coveting what everybody else has. That's what you need. That's what the enemy does. And you get depressed. Why? Because you're you. You're not them. You know, I want to be that guy, or I want to be that girl. I want to be them. You know, and the enemy says, but you're not. You're you. And you need to want to be them more. Why? So you get depressed and you get discouraged. You need to want what they have. Why? So you can't have it. And then you'll be really despairing. And does it work? Oh, man, does it work? Does it work? Man, look around. Look at the world that we live in. Look at the Christians around you. Many of them are stuck in this. They're like David here. He likes to remind us, the enemy does, that we failed, that our sins are, hey, that's stuff you need to just realize, and you're never going to change it. It's never going to go away. And David here is buying into it in a sense. He knows he's paying for sin. He knows he's dealing with the consequences of sin, but he's allowing the enemy to dig a hole for him to climb into with that. Again, you understand, I understand, we're paying for sinful stuff in our lives sometimes. Am I dealing with sin that I had years ago? Am I still dealing with it? Yes. Is it forgiven? Sure. Is there consequences I'm still dealing with? Yep. I have bad hearing because I was a rock and roll drummer for years, you know. Am I forgiven? Yep. Am I still half deaf? Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Some of you are the same way. You got that thing going on. What's it called? Tinnitus or something? It sounds like there's a little static in your ear all the whole time. That's what I live with daily. You know, don't you feel sorry for me? I am dealing with something that I perpetrated on myself. I'm forgiven for every place I played in, every Led Zeppelin song I sang. But I'm still half deaf because of it. And that's not going to change. It's just not. So David here is being reminded of all these things, and he's starting to feel guilty, and he's starting to have despair, and he's starting to realize that this thing is because of his sin, and that's true, but he's taking it further, and now the guilt and the disparity is sinking in, and he just starts falling into that pit. And he's sinking, you see. And like David, depression in us follows a direct path. First of all, when you get depressed, you will find that you will go into a mode of self-protection. What do you mean? I mean that you and I, when we start feeling like David, we're going to do what he did. And that is, we understand depression in one clinical sense, and that is, it always comes from being hurt. When you're depressed, listen, when I'm depressed, when David's depressed or anybody gets depressed, it's because something or someone has hurt you. That's where it comes from. You're hurt. And you are going to have to feel that hurt. And you don't know what to do with it. And so what David did and what we do oftentimes is we pull in to ourselves. What did he do? He went inside that room by himself and started moaning and groaning, having a depression party for himself, you see. Someone fails you. Someone hurts you, you see. And things don't work out. For David, it was his son being killed because of his own sin. Man, that's a heavy thing to carry around, you see. But he was trying to take the kingdom from David. He needed to be dealt with, obviously, but he's not thinking about that. Now, what should we do when this depression comes at us? What are we supposed to do with it? Well, the first thing you ought to do immediately, of course, is to face it for what it is. I've been hurt. Something hurt me. What is it? I don't know. Something hurt me. I'm going to pray about it. I'm going to give this over to the Lord. I'm going to surrender this to God. I'm going to take the word and apply it to that wound, and I'm going to let it heal it, and I'm going to move on. That's what we ought to do. But sometimes, like David is experiencing here, and maybe you have too, the hurt is too severe. It's too painful to even deal with. You just can't get there, it seems, right? And if that's the case, you're going to find yourself in the next phase of this problem called depression. First, you're going to be self-protective. And I mean by that, you're going to pull in. You're not going to allow yourself to be around others sometimes. One of the sure signs of depression for people is they withdraw from people. Why? Because I'm safe by myself, but I'm not safe around people. Why? Because people hurt. People hurt me. They confound me, or they cause me to feel the pain more. So I withdraw. That's the first sign, self-protection, you see. And if you continue in that, you'll find that interests go away. You're not interested in doing anything, right? Depressed people don't want to go anywhere. And they don't care about others as much anymore. They don't care what others are going through. You're going through something? Well, that's too bad. I'm depressed. Leave me alone. Right? I mean, is this ringing a bell in anybody's thinking? This is what happens to us. And if that continues, this isolation to protect yourself, to prevent being hurt again, if that continues on, the next step takes place, and that is self-pity. Self-protection first. I pull away. David goes into the room. And once he's in there, the pity party starts. Big time. And that's what happens with us. As soon as you're able to get away from people, you're free at that point to have a pity party on your own. Why? Because nobody else wants to be a part of a pity party, right? You got to have a pity party by yourself. You're the only one invited to that party, right? You don't invite others to that. Hey, why don't you come over Saturday night? I'm having a pity party. Just come and be pitiful with me. Okay, and that old term, misery loves company, not when it comes to self-pity. You don't want any company. Hey, let's go do this. No, I don't think so. What are you doing? Something real exciting. I'm going to stay home, have a pity party. You know, I'm just going to self-engulf. You know, I'm going to plunge in. And this is a dangerous place to go, folks. It really is. You can't stay there. If you stay there, man, you forget others have problems at all, and you just get so self-absorbed. That's where David's at here. And man, when that phase reaches its height, I'll tell you what else happens. The next step is self-punishment. So, self-protection, self-pity leads to self-punishment. What do you mean? You start feeling guilty about what you're doing. What are you doing? Pitying myself. Why are you pitying yourself? Because something happened and I feel hurt. And therefore, this whole thing perpetuates and leads you into punishing yourself for what now you're doing because of how you're responding to what you did do. And this thing is this is like a funnel, isn't it? It's like, you're going down. That's not getting you anywhere. It's not getting David anywhere either, you see. And these tendencies, these things that come at us, you see, you can't keep this up, you see. You're not being what you ought to be, and that makes you feel crummy. And so therefore, you're just going on and on with this, and you're punishing yourself and all the rest. Now, this is where Satan really goes to work when you've reached that point. Now you're punishing yourself, and he loves to kick you when you're down. And if you're going to kick yourself and punish yourself, he's going to have a party with you and kick you too. And that's where he really starts to put on the juice about your failures and everything you did. Yeah, you should be feeling that way. Right? You're the worst person I've ever met. You know, nobody likes you. Nobody wants to be with you anyway. You might as well be alone. Anybody heard any of those things? Those feelings of just, oh man, that's right, I am a loser. You know, I just should just go around like this every day. Just, you know, put one of those right on my head. You know, put two of them. Yeah, I'm a double loser. I just am, you know. And boy, is Satan having fun with you now, right? You're not having any fun, but he's having a blast at your expense, you see. And his hope is that you will isolate yourself and more every day, that you will pull away from everybody and everything. Why? So the next phase can kick in. What's that? Self-destruction. You go into self-destruct mode. And you can't take enough drugs. You can't drink enough booze. You can't watch enough TV. You can't do those things enough to destroy yourself quick enough. Do you understand this? It's such a plan of the enemy. And David here, you know, you can just imagine David's up there in that room just going through all this. And he's perpetrating this on himself. And it's an interesting thing. When you look at this, that you go, man, is there any need for this? No. There's no need for this routine. There's no need for it in me. And you might be thinking, hey, give David a break. Well, he lost his son. He's not really that depressed, is he? Isn't he? Let's see. We'll find out how depressed he really is. And when you see this happening, guys, to you, surrender to Jesus immediately. Tell him everything that you are feeling. Don't necessarily tell yourself or tell somebody else. Tell the Lord. Tell him how you feel. He can handle it. The psalmist, in many of the psalms, what's he doing? Telling the Lord what he feels. You know, many of the psalms start out, oh, my soul. Oy, oy, oy. I mean, wow, this is heavy, Lord. This hurts. I'm going through despair. My soul is in hell, the psalmist says. I'm feeling so heavy. I'm feeling so weighty. He tells the Lord. Two things happen. You get your eyes on the Lord at that point when you tell him everything that's going on. Secondly, you get your eyes off of yourself. David could not see anything but his own pitiful state. And boy, if that's all you've got eyes for, you're in trouble. You've got to get your eyes on the Lord, which gets your eyes off of you, which is the first step in this whole process of recovering out of this place called depression. Unload on the Lord. He can handle it. And again, your eyes will be back on your Lord instead of yourself. You see. Don't punish yourself. Confess your sin. The Lord's not punishing you. Why should you? He paid for your sin. Why should you be punishing yourself for sin that he forgave you for? You see. David's not being punished for his sin here. He's just living out the consequences. There's a difference, and you need to make sure that you don't place that in the place where you're just dealing with consequences rather than saying, oh yeah, it's because I am right now a failure. No, you may be dealing with something that came because you were a failure, you see. And how many things do you want to go back and look at in your life and say, hey, I could really have a pity party today if I just look back at about three things 30 years ago. I could really enjoy self-destruction because, man, I was awful or whatever. Don't do it, you see. Now, here's the thing. God forgives and forgets. Even if you don't feel that, if you don't feel that he forgives and forgets, even if your feelings don't match up with that, your faith has to. That's how you get your eyes on the Lord and off of yourself again. You have to realize by faith he forgave and forgets my sin. And even if I don't feel like it, I can't trust my feelings, can I? Can you trust your feelings? Let's see. How do you feel today? Terrible. Good. Well, I guess life's terrible. How do you feel today? Great. Oh, I guess life's great. Mm-hmm. Is that true? No. How you're feeling doesn't, you know, set the barometer for the universe. Although that's typically how I look at it. How am I doing? Well, that's the universal tendency then. I do great. The whole universe is great. I do lousy. Everything stinks. Right? It's not true. Your sin's forgiven because God declares it to be true. His word says it. His son died for it. Therefore, it's true. Whether you feel it or not, whether you feel better today or not, doesn't make any difference. That truth still stands. That's what you have to cling to. Got to quit clinging to feelings. That's the problem. But I do agree with this. You will feel better when you understand, finally, that this whole thing is a scheme, it's a plan, it's a setup. What are you going to do with this, David? How are you going to handle this? And David gets some instruction here that I think is key. And he gets it from an unlikely source. General Joab. And this is what we need sometimes. And it may come from an unlikely source, you know. It may come from a likely source, though, like your wife or your husband or your kids or your neighbor or some friend. A friend will do this, even though Joab, I probably wouldn't, you know, elect Joab to be the guy that comes to me in this scenario. I mean, when you listen to what he says, it's a little brutal, but he gets the job done. And sometimes we need this. We need this. What? This. Joab, verse 5 of chapter 19, came into the house to the king and said, "Thou hast shamed this day the faces of all thy servants, which this day have saved thy life, and the lives of thy sons, and the lives of thy daughters, and the lives of thy wives, and the lives of thy concubines. You shamed us all." Wow. In that, verse 6, "Thou lovest thine enemies and hatest thy friends. For thou hast declared this day that thou regardest neither princes nor servants. For this day I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all we had died this day, then it had pleased thee well." If we all died and he was alive out there, you'd be happy about that. Wow. This is intense, isn't it? Kind of like, get down, Joab. Dude, what are you saying here? But watch this. "Now therefore," verse 7, "arise, go forth and speak comfortably unto thy servants. For I swear by the Lord, if thou go not forth, there will not tarry one with thee this night that will be worse unto thee than all the evil that befell thee from thy youth until now." Verse 8, "So the king arose and sat in the gate. And they told all of the people, saying, Behold, the king doth sit in the gate. And all the people came before the king, for Israel had fled every man to his tent." They were all hiding shamefully before. What's Joab doing? Well, to paraphrase it, he says, snap out of it. Knock it off. You're shaming all these people that fought for you, that love you, that care for you, that have saved your life, saved your family, all these things that they've done for you. You're shaming them, and it seems like if we had all died and your son had lived, he'd be happy about that. And then he gives the instruction, get up and get going. Wow. And some would say, boy, Joab, cut him some slack. Joab's being used by the Lord here to get David up and going again. And there are times when I've had Joabs in my life who will say, that's enough. Get up and get going. You can't sit here in this pool of self-pity anymore. And I thank God for those. There are those to this day that are in my life that won't let me get by with this. Oh, it's one thing, again, to grieve and mourn something that's hard and heavy. But it's another thing to make everybody around you of no consequence whatsoever because you have decided that your grief is worse than everybody else's. And depression will set in then. And really what's happening here is David's being rescued from depression. And the Lord will be faithful to do that to you as well. There are times when people will come to me and I wrestle with this. I pray over it. They come in and they'll tell me their story. And I've been there with them before a number of times. They're depressed again and again. And again, life is a depression for them. It's totally depressing all the time. And there are times, not always, not immediately perhaps, but there comes a point where I'll have to play Joab. And I'll have to say, that's enough. Stop it. Get up, get out, and get going. You don't need me to be your pity partner. You need the Lord to give you strength, and he will, but he wants you getting up and get going. Start looking at him, quit looking at yourself. And you'll find there's release from depression. You know, that old saying is true. You know, if you want to quit being depressed, there's 10 things. Number one, do something for somebody else. Number two, repeat that 9 times. Just do it. Just do something for some. Just get off yourself. Just quit it. I came to the conclusion one time I was really depressed about something. And I finally, it hit me. It was like a revelation. I wasn't that important. I was making all this to do about me. And it wasn't that important. I wasn't that important. I didn't matter that much to the universe. If I was depressed or not, the universe did not go off its axis. You know what I mean? It just didn't affect anything. And I realized that in some small way, the Lord just said, do you understand this? It's not about you. That's huge. That was huge for me. Because now I realize it's not about me, it's about him. And I need to keep my eyes on him because it's all about him. That's what matters. He matters, not me. What you're feeling? Hey, it's nice to feel good, but it doesn't matter if you don't. Huh? Wait a minute. This is heresy. I mean, it is all about me and our hearts, right? Our minds, they recoil at this. We, no, you don't understand. I'm feeling this way. It's bad. It doesn't matter that much. Well, that doesn't help my situation. The Lord will help your situation when it's time. He'll get you through the problem when it's time. In the meanwhile, there's a thing called trust. There's a thing called faith. There's a thing called rest that he wants you to exercise regardless of what you feel like. Then you will have something that cannot move you anymore. That's what the Lord wants for you. He doesn't want you to be depressed. He doesn't want you to go through this cycle every time it, you know, comes around. Oh, here it comes again. You know, you don't have to go there. You don't have to suffer through it. You don't have to be a part of it. You can just say, Lord, you have your way. I'm done. I'm going to get up, and I'm going to get going, and I'm going to get on with it. Because my sin's forgiven, forgotten, and I'm done with that. I don't have to think about that anymore. Satan's a liar, isn't he? He comes at you and says, yeah, Well, you just say, get lost. My sin's forgiven based on the blood of the Lamb, based on the Bible. And I don't care what Satan says. I don't care what you say to me. I don't care what that word from you is. Get out of here. And I'm going to get up and get going. See ya. If that sounds simplistic to you, try it. Try it. And if it happens again, do it again and again and again and again. The Lord will be faithful. But remember, even depression, even going, it's a setup. How you respond to the Lord in this. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the word that you give to us. The things, Lord, that David went through, we go through as well. Heavy times, hardships. I pray, Lord, that in a sense, the word for us from Joab in our hearts would be the same. Get up and get going and let it go. I thank you for faithfully forgiving, for, Lord, so powerfully covering and dealing with my sin and my life. So many things, Lord, that you have sovereignty in that I need to trust you over. I thank you, Lord, that your goodness far outweighs my sin. And my failures, Lord, are covered totally by your success, your power. Bless you for that. Pray your covering over the rest of our day. Thank you, Lord, for teaching us your word. Give us now the Spirit, Lord, to empower this in our lives, in our hearts, to walk in it. That we would be, Lord, those that don't succumb to depression. That we would be, Lord, those that surrender to you. And you are the overcomer of all these things. Thank you for that. We commit this to you in Jesus' name. Amen.